Okay. So as Dr. Block just alluded to, we're going to be talking about cancer imaging. Hopefully it'll set it up not just for today's lecture, but for a lot of the upcoming lectures. You know, you're getting lectures on radiation oncology, medical oncology, or other one you'll see. Hopefully you'll be able to connect the dots and recognize that there is a commonality to this entire series, and imaging is one of those commonalities. Okay, so I see a lot of familiar faces, and I'm sure some of you have taken parts or have heard parts of this in other courses. If not, if you have, then hopefully you're an expert at what I'm going to talk about already. If you haven't, then hopefully you'll get a little bit enlightened. Okay, so there's my contact information anytime. Of course, during the lecture, feel free to stop me for any questions, clarifications, but after, email, phone, my office door is always open for students, so as long as I'm there. So, okay, let's get started. So one thing that I always try to impress upon everyone, or at least remind people, imaging is so ubiquitous, right? We're always seeing things. We're seeing images, we're seeing how things look, what we interpret them to be based on how they look, what it means to us, etc. So, sort of in a very philosophical way. What is an image? So these things that I put up there, you guys think they're these to be images? Should you say they're images or not?
Yes?
Okay. What is the difference? Do you see any difference between these images? Or what are some of the differences you can see?
Color.
Okay. Again, it's not a trick question. I am asking you, what do you see different? When you see these images, what are some of the differences? Color and one, what else?
Shapes,
okay, so more quality, right? The way they are depicting objects, okay, what else?
Clarity, objects.
Clarity is the resolution. So we'll talk a little bit about this resolution, right? So where you're looking at it from, how does it appear? So if I come and stand right next to you, and you kind of looking at you in a certain way as opposed to me just walking further away, right? Just like a microphone, you look at focal length, how I see things. I take my glasses off, I don't be able to see half of you in that background. So there's another way of looking at it, right? The resolution is going to change. What else? So all of these are trying to depict objects, right? But some of them are actually relying on the objects to actually interact with that energy that we're trying to utilize. So a lot of, at the end of it, if you look at any physical interaction, you know, some energy, whether it's light, you know, sound, it's interacting with tissue. In our case, for medical applications, it's with tissue, right? This is a radiograph, so it's actually teeth. There's a reason why bone appears a little bit different than the dental enamel, as opposed to like a soft tissue. So there's actually a feedback or a cross-talk between the two. So it's not just all about, it's like the old biology chart, right? Flashlight through your fingertips, white light looks red on the other side. Why is that? I just want to conceptually sort of make the wheels turn in your head that this is what I'm going to be talking to is a lot more intuitive than you think. And as long as you can recognize that, I don't think you'll have a problem. Okay, the other point I want to try to make is this, what is this? The barcode fits, right? Anything you do, you know, your winter jacket, your leggings, you hear that sound, your logic sweat. That's actually an image, believe it or not. It's actually a number that's encoding specific characteristics. But those numbers are actually what's reflecting what they actually supposed to connect with. Whether it's a SKU code for an object in inventory, you say, hey, what is the catalog number? That's what you're seeing. That's actually an image, believe it or not. Okay, so characteristics of all these images, clearly they're all different. One is a photograph, a color photograph, the other one's a microscopic image. That's a thumbprint. All of us have our own. You know, when you go to Canada or somewhere, a lot of biometrics, for example, that's what's relying on. Retinal scanners, thumbprint. It's a unique image from your, whether it's your retinal scan or your thumbprint, right? So again, imaging is everywhere. Okay, here's another example closer to home. You guys know who this is? Yes? No? Maybe? I'll give you a clue. Can't find his name at first.
Don't establish their own That's Dr. Ronald Park.
Oh, okay. That's a picture of him. So when you look at that photograph, right, that's an image of him. I've just blown it up just for you to get a perspective. At the end of the day, an image is really an array, a rectilinear array of pixels. So if you really start zooming in, you'll start seeing virtually every image, these little squares, right? That's what we call pixels. These picture elements are pixels. These are basically, look at them as data points in your image. And most images comprise this, at least certainly 2D images. So when you talk about an array, then you're really talking to different array or directions, X and Y. In a small, simple digital image, you'll have pixels. Same thing here. You have pixels, rows and columns, which is really what it's referring to. And typically, each image makes up is made up with a certain number of pixels, what we call pixel dimension. That has X number of pixels horizontal and on the Y direction. That really determines, and I don't know if you guys have all probably generated some figure or the other, right? PowerPoint, figure talks, papers, figures, every image you try to copy and paste. If you click on, right click on the adaptation image software, Adobe or anything, it will tell you what that image size is, right? 156 by 156, 212. Those are all telling you a couple of different things. Pixel dimensions is one of them. So a lot of times, if you had a really big image, typically that determines the file size you like, so you can see it bigger. Now we'll talk a little bit about resolution in the initial images, right? So let's get into what really resolution is referring to. Resolution as a term is really describing the spatial dimensions of the image. And this can either be described as the number of elements that make up that image, and that image element could either be dots per inch or pixels. And so resolution as a simple mathematical readout is really giving you a sense as to what is the relative ratio of your pixels in relation to the actual physical dimensions of the image. Here's a simple example, straightforward example. You guys may have heard this, that people referring to images as, oh, what resolution? You know, you try to submit a figure to a journal. They're all going to publish papers, right? You want to publish paper, you upload your figure and it says, oh, images need to be at least 300 dpi. There's a certain quality that you're expecting. Why is that? That's a certain resolution that needs to be achieved in order when it's finally printed, it actually is visible. As opposed to your cell phone picture click, although cell phone resolution can change as well. So what are they referring to? DPI. So if your image, this is really what they're referring to, the resolution of that image. So if you had an image dimension that's 10 by 7.5 inches, and your pixel dimensions were 720 and by 540, what would the resolution be? Again, not a trick question. The resolution is dictated by the pixel dimensions over the physical dimensions. Your pixel dimensions are 720 over the actual length of the image. There, 72 dpi. That's the resolution here. So the 300 dpi number I gave you is much higher. This is a relatively. So the lower your dpi, the less resolution your image is. And again, resolution translates into detail. Right? There's a reason why all those things scale up and down. The images you get, if you were to put a camera on, and when the images you get from a drone is different from the images you get from a cell phone, right? What is the difference? It could be the same capacity, but it varies in resolution. Okay, back to the idea of pixels. And again, these are all fairly common. You guys all use this routinely. Probably not fully aware of it, but PPI, UPI, your printers. You send a print job to your department, turn it out of hall. Right, your color printer at home, your laser inkjet is that. It's all printing out, it's all the capability of that particular machine or monitor or printer that's telling you. You could have a spectacular image, high resolution image from your cell phone store, but if the printer's capability doesn't let you, you still get a crappy looking image, right? Again, it's describing to you what exactly those particular instruments can or cannot do. So number of pixels or dots in a printed image. Typically, you want there's something called dithering where you actually use multiple dots to create a pixel. So your output can either be DPI or PPI. And typically, because multiple dots make up a pixel, you would need more DPI to recapitulate the same degree of detail. Okay. So again, trying to connect this to what you would do. All of you have smartphones, I'm assuming the majority of you have smartphones, right? iPhone 6, 7, I don't know whether they have 8 right now. Mine's the 6. So you have digital cameras, right? I remember 10 years ago, I had a 2 megapixel camera, it was really good. But now your telephone probably has a 16 megapixel camera, right? What does that mean? So now if you look at one of the measures of understanding this is the number of megapixels. This is just a table that I put in there. A lot of times cameras are actually referring to the maximum print size of a certain dimension within that range. So if you had a 3 megapixel camera, and if you wanted a 300 ppi resolution image to be printed, that's the maximum size of your image in order to get that resolution. So it's really a metric that combines the resolution capabilities, in this case of your cell phone, with concepts that are used in imaging. So megapixel, as it implies, million pixels. So for a certain resolution, 300, 200, whatever it is, there's a maximum print size you can get for a given number of megapixels. That's why, obviously, the more you go, if you have a 22 megapixel camera, you can generate an image that's much bigger for that same resolution as opposed to a 2 megapixel camera. I put the personal example, my iPhone 6 has an 8 megapixel camera, which means at 300 ppi, if I wanted an image, that's the most I can get on my current size. So it's really a metric, again, I'm not going to quiz you on what your cell phone can take or what kind of images you can generate, but conceptually try to recognize that this is all, and a lot of what I'm going to be talking to you about today, you are going to be active. Most of you are masters of graduate students, right? Most of you are working on some research project or the other. All of this will hopefully come in handy when you're thinking of those data sets that you're generating. So here's another example, resolution. This is actually what we call a vascular cast. You inject a resin into an animal, and the resin actually goes inside the blood vessel and solidifies, and you can actually then excise the tissues of interest, in this case the kidney, and dissolve all the other connective tissue and whatnot away, and what you end up forming or seeing is just what the resin went to solidify. So it's actually giving you spectacular resolution. Obviously, it's invasive, not a non-invasive way of thinking things. You can see this is actually an example of a normal kidney, and this is a single glomerular unit. So think about this, the resolution which you're looking at. So this image is a 512 by 512 image. Remember I told you that array, so it's a 512 X and Y image. Now if I basically change, not the magnification, but the resolution of the image, not how I'm zooming in or zooming out, but actual way in which it was captured. If I did a 256 by 256 instead, I don't know if you can appreciate it, but you actually lost that little bit of resolution, right? Hopefully you'll see it more. Now we go down 128 by 128, 64 by 64, 8 by 8, 4 by 4. So basically, every time I've gone down the resolution, you can see that the pixel dimensions have basically gone up, right? So remember I told you the more detail you want to capture. It's a unit of information. So now, it's the same image, the dimensions haven't changed across, right? This is the exact same XY, the dimension hasn't changed, it's just the resolution has changed. Now so that means magnification is one thing, resolution is a completely different thing. So I want you to recognize that. And so resolution is what determines image quality, not whether you don't. And this is why when you look at your PowerPoint, right? So you have a seminar, you have a journal club, you grab a figure from a published paper and put it to your PowerPoint slide, and you just stress the heck out of it. You cover the whole screen, all of a sudden the image looks blurry. Why is that? You just basically zoomed into an image. Right, you change the way that image looks. You didn't resize the image, you scale up the resolution, you just made it bigger. Same idea. Okay, here are some examples. So now I've given you some flavor on basic imaging, right? So how many of you can recognize these images? Or can you recognize any of these images? Yeah, that's a great question. What does this look like?
Why?
Okay, that's one person. Do you agree? Disagree? Agree? Okay. What's this? That's actually okay. Is this? I hear whispers. No takers. I know some of you have actually sat through going out of the courses, so you don't want me pointing at people. And that, what's your answer? What do you think that is? No idea? Okay, handles. Thoughts, are you writing down your handouts? Whatever you think it is, there's no right or wrong answer at this point. We're just going to discuss. One reason I'm bringing this to your attention is actually for you to recognize what you know and what you don't know, or what you think you might know, right? What's this? What does this look like? And it's okay to not know. Hopefully, the end of the lecture you'll know. This is a test can? Okay. And then, what's this? Ultrasound? Okay. I have one or two people with some suggestions. There's no consensus apparently with you guys. So maybe towards the end when you revisit it, we'll go back. Okay? Alright, so the point of me showing that is to illustrate one fundamental thing in imaging. There's a reason why you have so many of these methods. And the answer to that, the reason for that is that no single imaging method will give you all of the answers. So I introduced the concept of resolution and detail and capturing information, right? I showed you those images with different color, intensity, etc. Medical imaging is no different. From the early 1900s when x-rays were discovered all the way to, this is almost 10 years old now, we've had a whole gamut of imaging methods that have come on for medical applications. And I'm not even going to be talking about non-medical applications, primarily medicine and certainly oncology. This includes ultrasound, PET, MRI, CT. There's also PET CT, which is combining multiple methods. There's also individual methods within MRI and CT, all of which are attempting to increase. The objective is the same. Maximal resolution with hopefully an optimal cost, and hopefully it's not too technically demanding, so it can actually be able to use, but it's easier said than done. So that's the primary reason we actually have multiple methods to actually obtain complementary information, that no single method can give you all the answers. Okay, that's in the clinical space. In the preclinical space, again, one of the things that I didn't mention to you before, you guys have cultured cells and you've looked at your cells under a microscope, you've done imaging, right? So microscopy is part of that imaging methods, predominantly bright light or fluorescence over the last, certainly over the last 100 years, but now there's a lot more fluorescence, confocal, high resolution endoscopic procedures. But in the preclinical space, again, you have the same or a similar explosion of imaging methods. And we'll talk a little bit about these. There's bioluminescence, there's fluorescence, there's tomographic methods, CT and MR, similar to what you use in patients. Okay. I just alluded to this. And again, this table is another way of you to just recognize. Again, don't worry about every last detail on the table, but recognize conceptually what I just said. Each of these methods have limits to resolution and sensitivity. What can they detect? How small? And what does it take to detect that? In addition, as we will talk about throughout the rest of my talk, the basis for contrast itself is different between these methodologies. How they actually generate information. Just like the initial one I showed you, a digital photograph is different from a barcode, it's different from a microscopic image. You'll recognize. So we'll talk about some of these, not all, not so much in detail, but I'll try to cover a lot of ground. Recognize that the spatial resolution varies across the board. As you go from, so PET, for example, is not spatially, doesn't have high resolution, but you can go CT and MR, for example, you can go a lot higher in terms of resolution in the same mix. Another example, depth is not an issue for PET, CT, or MR, but it is an issue for optical methods. Light penetration is often influenced by what the tissue so things absorb, that means the amount of energy that light scatters, the amount of signal that you get back is influenced by the depth at which you're imaging. Not so much for MR and CT and PET. PET and CT utilize ionizing radiation or radioactive tracers. MR actually doesn't, so it actually utilizes non-ionizing radiation. That's an advantage. Give you soft tissue contrast. And almost all of these imaging methods can actually utilize what we call exogenous agents, contrast enhanced agents. So in addition to the native contrast that you can exploit within tissue, you can inject agents into living tissue, living subjects, animals, patients, etc., to enhance that contrast. And we'll talk a little bit about that. Okay. So now again, zooming back into what exactly is imaging used for in medicine, certainly oncology. So there, if you look at the paradigm, clinical paradigm in oncology, right? Patient presents with a lesion. In this case, there's a lesion of the tongue, either symptomatic, complaints of pain or swelling. That's how they present maybe to the primary care physician who refers them to what they place at Roswell. And then they undergo clinical examination, and one form or the other of an imaging method, the BCT, the PET, the X-ray, or the PET. In this case, that's actually shown with the CT. So that's the clinical exam, clinical presentation. And then you have an imaging method. In this case, it's showing you the extent of the tumor. That's the manual. You're looking at the extent of the tumor, the arrows point the outline. Then you also get a microscopic image, histopathologic assessment. So two different kinds of imaging methods, actually, at that point. And then, which helps us to diagnose and stage the patient, which then, hopefully, helps us develop a treatment plan, which is either standard care, could be surgery, could be chemotherapy, radiation, or, quote, targeted therapy, right? That's the paradigm in which imaging plays a role. So for most practical purposes, in fact, if you look at most clinical departments, you know, it's called diagnostic radiology. That's a historical application. It's for tumor, Mr. Jones. Tumor or tumor? That's sort of a minor. I'll hopefully, during the course of this, you'll be able to appreciate it more than just diagnostic. You can also use it as a screening tool. For example, we have screening trials using imaging, CT, for example, for lung cancer patients, or even autofluorescence imaging for oral cancer patients we've had in the past. There's another way to look for applying imaging methods. In addition to, that's the basic oncology. In addition, radiation oncology, which I mentioned is one of the treatment options for cancer, also utilizes imaging, probably more so than other aspects. And in this case, imaging actually plays a role in treatment planning itself, even delivering that care. So how does it do that? So here's an example of a CT scan. The patient with glioma has a brain tumor there. You actually use these imaging CT data sets to plan how you're going to deliver the radiation. Keep in mind, ultimately, any cancer therapy, the ultimate goal is maximize tumor cell kill, minimize normal tissue collateral damage, right? The radiation, so you can't just go and just blast the entire region, particularly the sensitive area of the brain, the head and neck, etc. So which means, this is now being used to actually delineate exactly where the tumor is. How do we actually maximally deliver the radiation dose to the tumor, yet not cause collateral damage that, in some cases, could be lethal to the patient? So this is actually enabling you to deliver your treatment. I'll get back to this towards the end in terms of other image-guided interventions, but in radiation oncology, imaging is such an integral part of that treatment planning itself. Then, of course, when you talk about collateral damage, you're identifying organs at risk, and your goal is to spare these organs from getting irradiated, and also to come up with an optimal strategy. Keep in mind, one of the things that I mentioned before, the early images we were looking at were all planar, 2D images, right? So you're just looking at page slide, or one just looking at it in one view. Clinical imaging, for the most part, CT, MR, PET, that are three-dimensional. Actually get volumetric data. So you're actually going to be able to reconstruct that. You get much more than just one simple slice planar image. And so you can actually compute the entire volume that you're going to be using in your treatment plan. In addition, in medical oncology and therapeutics, drug development, etc., imaging has a role to play in the entire pipeline, all the way from target screening to being in the form of an optical recorder in your cell lines to ultimately using it in patients and basically trials and ultimate FDA approval. Okay, so when I mentioned imaging being used to monitor therapy or assess response. One of the things that I want you to appreciate is one of the most commonly utilized methods for using imaging as a readout of response. Like the patient comes in, diagnosed with an invasive cancer, underwent treatment with a curative intent, two cycles, three cycles, let's say 3 months later, you want to see if they respond, if they not respond, are they, of course the clinical symptoms help, right? Of course the patient is going to tell you. But what is the objective measure of whether or not your treatment's working? This is one of the ways to assess that. That's why it's called RECIST, stands for Response Evaluation Criteria in Solid Tumors. There have been multiple iterations of this over the years, but just remember what this is basically an objective standard measure by which you can actually assess whether or not your tumor responded or not to the therapy. So the way you do it is you have a baseline scan and then you have a post-treatment scan. And what you do is you compare the images morphologically just to size. You do a cross-sectional assessment and see what happens. So one of three things might happen. One of four things might happen. But essentially the fourth category is sort of in between the other two. One of three things will happen, right? Okay, I didn't know the cancer I get treated. Either my tumor goes away. Great. Maybe goes away, but that can be shrinks. It doesn't go away. So there was a response. Or doesn't care. Keep growing. That's really what you're trying to say. So you have a complete response where, great, you know, everything disappeared. Or you have a partial response. Like I said, there's a percentage to which it actually goes down. There's a lot of times you'll see this, even if you're reading papers about published work, right? If you're reading, regardless of what cancer you're studying or what drug development process you're involved in, outcome data, you say progression-free survival, you'll see response data saying overall response rate. What does that mean? It's defining response in some way, right? A lot of times, again, overall survival is a very good measure. But you'll actually see what happens and say, oh, well, X percentage of patients showed a partial response at this time point post therapeutic intervention. Most times it looks like this. Some kind of a defined response. So the nice thing about this is that it's a very simple measure. That's the good news about it. So that's the reason why it's also fairly widely utilized. Right? You have, and this doesn't even have to be a particular method. Most of them have either CT or MR, but you could actually utilize this across the board. So if a medical oncologist at Rock Hill is trying to participate in a multi-institutional trial with Pittsburgh or UCSF, and maybe Duke, and they're all trying to put together, and that's what you have in institutional trials, so a multi-institutional trial, a cooperative group trial. That has to be some standard nomenclature, right? We can define a response a certain way. Duke called it some other way, and then we're trying to reach the data up, and it's really not what you would want. So this allows us to actually develop a common language of efficacy. So, fantastic. It's easy, straightforward, widely used. So what's the issue? Problem is, you guys have probably seen this from your last semester, right? Or some updated version of this. The landmark paper called Hallmarks of Cancer. Yes? No? Okay. So this is, and of course, this is I think somewhere in the figure legend, it will probably say a simplified version, right? This is a simple version of what's really happening, which means there are lots of pathways, lots of receptors, lots of signaling going on within these tumor cells. And mind you, this doesn't even account for the crosstalk between tumor cells and the stromal cell, the tumor microenvironment, which means we recognize now more than we did probably 20 or 30 years ago that this is molecular. This is why it's 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we started using targeted therapies, right? Each of these pathways, when you look at them, there have been agents that have been developed to study or target these. So the problem we have, this is revisiting that, is we recognize the hallmarks of cancer, and virtually every hallmark of cancer is being exploited for therapeutic benefit. The problem is, they all work differently. They don't all do the same thing, which means your readout. Ultimately, of course, you do want to see that tumor go away. So at an end point, needless to say, tumor disappearance of the tumor overall throughout the patient is the definitive readout, but that happens the way it went wrong. What we've learned with these agents is, one, their mechanism of action is so diverse checkpoint inhibitors, immunotherapy is hot right now. Anti-angiogenic therapy used to be hot 8 to 10 years ago, right? And they always say there's bad blood now with those kinds of agents. Inflammatory drugs have some roles to play. Deoxynivalenes, historic classic chemical chemotherapeutic agents, are still being utilized, which means all of these signaling agents, signaling inhibitors, EGFR inhibitors, receptor kinase inhibitors, all FDA approved. To that point, all of these cause different differential effects in the tumor. And what I mean by that is really not necessarily all these classes of agents don't cause tumor shrinkage, might still be in the target. So you can still be blocking EGFR signaling, yet the tumor may not care that you block EGFR signaling. So there's two different things. Right? One is to see if your drug is actually doing what you wanted it to do. And the second aspect of it is that significant? Because there are so many drivers of that cancer, maybe just blocking one doesn't matter, right? This has now created a huge conundrum where we don't know. This is, you guys have all probably heard of, used to be personalized genetic medicine, not precision medicine, right? The idea behind precision medicine is that it's not do the blanket, everybody who walks through the door gets this biopsy cafeteria, no matter what. Historical cocktail of chemotherapy, right? The idea is, we're going to find out. If I get diagnosed, we're going to find out whether it's by sequencing, you want to do genomic analysis, molecular or pathologic assessment, what is really driving my cancer. Therefore, then target my cancer with the agent that can actually hit these drivers. So that means patient selection has become part of an issue. How are we going to select these patients? Do we just look for a receptor that's overexpressed? Perhaps some utility in that. Do we look for signatures, immune profiles? All these things are being studied, yet there's no clear winner, right? And keep in mind, biopsy, one of the limitations of biopsies, you take whether it's a punch biopsy, you take a little bit of the shaving of the tumor, that typically you're looking at a 5-micron slot, say, section, cross section of the tumor, and making an assumption about a 6 centimeter mass, right? So the heterogeneity, you guys haven't heard the word enough. That's a big issue. You're assuming, well, this is perhaps reflective of the real thing. So again, patient selection has become a big problem. Endpoint assessment, as I just alluded to, all these drugs work differently, do different things. Some, they don't always cause shrinkage of the tumor, but still might do what they're supposed to do. So which means, all these animals, again, here's an example to illustrate that point. This is just four different pathways, right? Just the common suspects, the usual suspects. VEGF receptor, vasodilatory growth factor, epidermal growth factor, you've got the family, the EGFR family, insulin. This is just four simplistic pathways in the tumor itself that are known to be drivers of different cancers. For each pathway, you have about 4 to 6 drugs. There's not even a class. There's one thing for different classes of agents, and then within the same class, you have multiple agents. So you could target, for example, for VEGF, you could target, you could use a monoclonal antibody to block the VEGF signaling, the outside, or you could use a tyrosine kinase inhibitor that's actually blocking the receptor tyrosine kinase phosphorylation, dimerization, therefore downstream activation of that. And just multiply that from every other pathway that we've discovered. And this is just 4. You can quickly see how things add up. Now we're with 20 drugs with just 4 pathways, all of which presumably have different safety profiles, different pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic profiles, and toxicity profiles. How do you start assessing? What is the endpoint? Don't know. This is the problem. So it's raising the question, is this criteria good enough? What you really want, again, is volume. Think of an example. If I'm 70 years old, I got diagnosed with advanced stage cancer, you're just looking through chemo-RT, surgery, chemo-RT, and like say some target therapy. And then 7 months, 6 months later, or 5 months later, you tell me my tumor is not responding. Too late, right? It's too late for the patient. It's too late in the game to try and change and alter the treatment plan with the potential hope of modifying the response. A lot of times our best chance of cure cancer is our first chance. Which means all these ultimate measures of outcome, it's great when we get cured, but none of the fail. I just went through a horribly toxic therapeutic treatment, you know, regimen for 5 months, and my tumor is not responding, it kept growing. And I've suffered the collateral damage, quality of life. So the key is what? Is actually to find out early on. And I put in a response, not necessarily positive, just a response. Because even if you're going to fail, if I'm going to fail, the treatment got on. I would love to know that that treatment's not working a month into it, a couple weeks ago, instead of 6 months ago. That's the clinical need. So what's the problem with this? It's measuring the size of morphology, and a lot of the traditional chemotherapy, therapeutic agents were cytotoxic, but the model was actually cytostatic. So they may not actually cause the size change. This, again, I mentioned heterogeneity. Size is a very crude measure. It doesn't really account for that heterogeneity. Parts of the tumor that are actually responsive, some parts that are not. Again, it is not a sensitive enough measure of the biological activity of the HCP-targeted agents. And as I mentioned, a late readout is a non-specific readout. Something early on would be useful. Okay, that brings me to the change in radiology of the field. 15 years ago, things started shifting. We're still moving towards the space of molecular imaging where you're not just seeing things, how big they are, how small they are, you're actually beginning to understand processes. Functional entities is becoming much more important and relevant, particularly with these targeted therapies. And the idea is you will not just visualize the set of morphological characteristics, you'll actually measure functional characteristics, and I'll get to what those functional characteristics are in a bit. You will get 2D, 3D images, temporal, longitudinal images over time to quantify. And one of the nice things about this molecular imaging is actually a very interdisciplinary field. There are geneticists working on this, molecular biologists, there are chemists, there are physicists, all of whom sort of intersect in that space that brings together all these disciplines. Okay, I mentioned some of these functional characteristics, right? What are these? So if you look at, again, the hallmarks of cancer, there are manifestations of all these hallmarks. Functional manifestation, right? One is metabolism, metabolic activity. You can measure that with hypoxia. Tumors are inherently aberrant in their vascularity, so they actually cause these variations in blood flow and oxygenation. You can measure that. You can measure proliferation. You can measure metastatic disease. You can even measure cell kill or apoptosis, cell death. So we'll talk a little bit about all of these. Okay, so as I mentioned, there are a lot of different imaging methods that are actively and clinically employed. I'm going to quickly go through and we'll put the caveat that we have a semester-long course on just on MRI, so it's going to be, it's okay if you are not able to understand if you left there, but certainly I'm happy to talk to you after or communicate with you any questions, details you need. But suffice to say, I want you to understand at least the broad concept. At the end of the lecture, at least you can recognize the difference between what an MR image like. Or how is an MRI generated versus how is it generated? Okay. MRI, as the name implies, stands for magnetic resonance imaging. It relates to a combination of a magnetic field, nuclear resonance, and a radio frequency. So it's actually RF pulse. And what typically, one of the most commonly imaged nuclei are protons. The body's full of water, it's an abundant proton. So we actually exploit that for contrast. Here's a cross-section of an MR scanner. It's actually what you would see in the clinic. You also have a preclinical MR scanner for animal research. Looks similar with some modifications, but you have the main magnetic field, it's a superconducting magnet, and you have these additional gradients that actually alter the magnetic field. And when you use the RF pulse to excite the protons, there's a difference between the number of protons that are aligned with the field versus those that are opposed. That little difference is what actually gives you your signal when you actually excite them with these radio frequency pulses, and you end up getting these pretty exquisite soft tissue contrast. This is without any contrast. You can see that this is a what we call the sagittal view of a human. That's the brain, you can see the nasal cavities, the pharynx, etc. So again, the basis for contrast in MR is really is the proton in the native environment they're in. Where they're in and what they're experiencing when you actually subject them to the magnetic field and the RF pulse. So if you look at a tissue of interest, in this case the brain, you have these tissue you're supposed to make in the field, and you pulse them with radio frequency, which is in resonance, meaning the same frequency as the precessional frequency of these protons, and so you get within a voxel. Voxel, I didn't mention before, a voxel is essentially a 3D pixel. That's what this is, the cube instead of a square. You will see that some of these protons align, some of them are a very small number will be against it, and so you actually get that difference to give you a signal. And don't worry about all these details, but suffice to say, proton density, the number of protons, the amount of protons influences your signal, and the individual characteristics, what is the kind of environment that water is in. We'll use some examples to better illustrate that. So contrast comes from the fact that you can manipulate some of these. There are acquisition protocols that you can modify in order to get an image that gives you adequate contrast. There are also, as I mentioned, the density of the protons, the easiest way to look at your lungs. You don't have to live in your life without having water on an MR. It'll basically look black, not really anything. If you add a cystic fluid, the brain, you can certainly get a lot of signal with the ventricles. If you have a ascites, basically a lot of focal liquid, fluid, water, you're going to see a lot more signal come to those. And as I mentioned, there are agents that can also enhance this contrast. Here's an example. This is what we call the T1 weighted image. This is just anatomic image right now, looking at the tumor. I think you can see on one kind of a contrast image, that's actually looking at the tongue, you're looking at the muscle. There is a tumor there. That arrow is actually pointed at the muscle, but it's actually a mass. You can't quite appreciate the contrast in this image, but if you were to do a T2 weight, it's slightly off of the weighting on your scan protocol. You can now actually get better delineation of that mass. It's still invading that muscle, which is in the floor of your mouth, but you can now see just a simple anatomic MR image can give you the contrast nice with a lot of light of the tumor. Again, morphologic assessment, fine. Functional imaging, which is what I alluded to before, is actually doing a little bit more than that. Typically, one of the commonly utilized methods in MR is called dynamic contrast enhanced MR, where you basically inject a contrast enhancing agent intravenously, typically means gathering more iron oxide into the agents that are used. But what you do is you acquire the name dynamic, implying you're acquiring a time series. A series of images before and after injection of this agent. And then you're sampling your tissue of interest, or in this case, tumor. You intravenously inject the contrast. So what you're seeing is indirectly a measure of a signal change, a readout, signal intensity, for simple reasons, over time. So you actually see this curve before you injected the agent, and then you see the spike over as soon as you inject the contrast slowly, of course, it clears out. That's in the vessel. You can also shift that to the tumor, the kinetics of which are different. Now you end up getting essentially an intensity, time intensity profile. Right? How did it look? Did it enhance? How long did it take to enhance? You can now model those temporal data sets to relate the enhancement pattern to what's really, what is it reflecting? What is the underlying tumor biology that's being reflected? Again, it's a little more complicated. I'm trying to simplify it in the interest of time, but there's a lot more that goes on to get to this point. But suffice to say, the basic methodology is you acquire a time series before and after injection of this natural enhancing agent. You process that kinetic data to extrapolate that to what's really being measured. Could be blood flow, volume, or permeability by analyzing that time-dependent tracer concentration. Here's a simple example. This is a study done in humans. It's a breast. You're looking at a lesion in the breast. It's a breast tumor in one patient, but this is multiple patients. You can measure the change in the signal intensity of these of this lesion, for example, as you're injecting. So you're, again, keep in mind, there's a baseline series that you're acquiring for a couple of minutes, in this case a couple of seconds, and you push the IV contrast agents, your signal goes up. Again, a couple of things happen. They either keep going up, or goes up and clears out, or slowly, gradually goes up and plateaus, regardless of what happens, and depending on where it is too, you'll see the profiles differ between tumor and fat and normal tissue. Here's the other example that illustrates that visually. early enhancement is referring to early on in this phase when you're actually seeing a lot more enhancement in the tumor, not so much in the surrounding tissue. You can see this, your normal tissue, that little slope between pre and post injection is a lot less. But if you wait long enough, this agent is now leaking directly out of that tissue, so you're actually seeing a lot more diffuse out of that surrounding tissue outside the tumor. So your enhancement pattern, and people have done this, and this is one of the studies where you can actually relate disease aggressiveness to this enhancement pattern. Depending on what that curve looks like, it's actually reflecting the underlying biology of that particular cancer. You can generate parametric maps, do a little bit more fancy, what you call pharmacokinetic modeling. You can actually sample the amount of contrast agent in the blood that's flowing through that tissue of interest. You can get a subtraction image, that's a basic Gaussian image, which is post-contrast, pre-contrast image. You can then essentially, for every data point you get on the curve, you have an image. You can actually get what we call a parametric map of that lesion at any point in time. K-trans, for example, is essentially a measure of the amount of contrast agent that leaks in that, within that tumor. So you can now model that. There's also another constant, which is referring to the extravascular extracellular space, which is the amount that actually diffused out in that mass, as you can see. That pattern of distribution is different from what's really leaking inside the tumor. All of these are now telling you a lot of things about how is the functionality of the blood vessels in the tumor. How leaky are they? Leakiness, for example, even in gliomas and breast tumors, has been correlated with disease, right? More leaky, this probably bad. So these are all parameters that are now being exploited. Another example in head and neck patients, these are actually two different patients with either lymph nodes, head and neck cancer, regionally spread the lymph nodes. Here you're seeing a contrast enhanced image, again, generating parametric maps, similar to what I showed you in the previous slide, but you're looking at what we call a pseudo-colorized image. The image is not color, we just impose it so we can visualize it. You can see the pattern of leakage in this lymph node versus this tumor in the lymph node is dramatically different. You're seeing a lot more leakage here. This one actually looks a lot more necrotic. You're not seeing a full out contrast accumulation. And this is what we typically call a cystic or necrotic looking lymph node. And this is also an indicator of disease aggression. And you can also measure now. And keep in mind, if you were this was, you could do this pre and post treatment, presumably the size of the lymph nodes may not really be different. Yet the composition of the disease, the tumor in that, in those lymph nodes is dramatically different. And it's reflective of functionality. So that's MRI. PET is another modality that's used quite a bit, magnetized resonance tomography. Slightly different in how it works. You basically have a radioactive tracer that's injected into the body, which is your radionuclide. That actually, when that radionuclide decays, you actually have this positron that's emitted. It travels a little bit a distance with the tissue, and then it can basically interact with the electron, leading to two gamma rays that are produced. Those, that essentially the mass of those two particles is converted into these gamma rays, and you have a detector that's picking those two events up. This is the one-on-one PET. So basically, it's with your PET scanner. If any of you, of course, if any of you want to or have not seen or are curious about seeing any of these imaging methods, MRI, CT, or PET, I'll be happy to schedule some time and show you what it actually looks like, whether it's in patients or humans, doesn't matter, if you think it might help. So your scanner basically looks, the gantry looks like this. You have a detector that's picking up all these events. You have a whole series of rings that's basically registering these events. And it's collecting all of these events together. And then using CT-based reconstruction methods, it's putting together the actual cross-sectional image. Just like MR, I mentioned iron oxide gadolinium, you can use different radionuclides. They all have different half-lives. They're slightly different in the way they're made. Most commonly utilized PET tracer is glucose, FDG. This is, if you may have heard this when you hear PET, typically FDG PET. There are other tracers as well. So the way the glucose has been utilized for a long time in oncology is this, you utilize this radiolabeled glucose essentially. Because super cells actually don't have these, are highly metabolically active, so they actually gobble up glucose. But that FDG that you injected actually undergoes phosphorylation. And unfortunately, in these cells cannot actually be broken down any further, so you actually end up getting this be trapped in the cells. This is why we end up seeing a hot spot in the tumor. Most metabolically active tissues will light up, not just tumor. Brain, for example, will light up as well. But on the relative scale, it's always based on background. There are ways to also analyze the data set. I can get into the details of it, but there are quantifiable parameters that standardize uptake value, how much more than a normal tissue am I seeing. So that's another indication of how much metabolically active the tumor is. These are, again, examples of tracers. They all vary in their half-lives, and some of them are actually used for specific readouts, oxygenation, angiogenesis, etc. Here's what a PET image looks like. So that's, you end up seeing, again, you are going to see the tracer elsewhere, but you end up seeing this, what's called a hotspot, right? So you, again, these are pseudocolorite point you. You're not getting, I could overlay a different color scale on this. So don't worry about the colors itself. It's just the fact that you're trying to generate contrast. But as I pointed out before, MR actually has exquisite soft tissue contrast. So if I actually didn't show you this image, and I just showed you this image, I'm only the best I'm going to pick up what anatomical region I'm referring to. Right in the bottom. So spatially, and that goes back to that first slide that I showed you, spatially, PET doesn't have great resolution. Can't quite create it because it's the signal is specific to what you did, but you would need another image, a CT or an MR. This is why I mentioned at the beginning, a lot of routinely, in fact, even here, we do a lot of PET CT images. Complementary information. PET has great specificity and sensitivity. CT has great resolution. Spatially co-registered. So that's what you're seeing here. This is the same patient, a CT image. That's really the normal mass that you're seeing. You can now co-register. It's not perfect, but you can actually see that ring of metabolic activity is actually where that tumor is. So what you wouldn't be able to see with this, you can see with this, and vice versa. You can also use it preclinically, has been utilized or is actively being utilized. You can make targeted agents. I mentioned targeting the VEGF pathway, the pathway, the vascular growth pathway. So you can make a radioactive tracer. In this case, they actually made a VEGF quantum dot, which is also optically active, but also tagged to a radioactive tracer. So you can now image the efficacy of this non-targeted versus targeted, although based on this, it doesn't look that impressive. But what they're trying to show here is actually these are two different tumors, and they're trying to show these tumors in these mice. I don't know if these images project well, but you can actually use the VEGF targeted quantum dot to localize to specifically in the tumor. Again, keep in mind, that's the liver of the mouse. You can see a huge amount of signal there, right? This is always in the location of the tracer, whether it's contrast agent for the MR or PET. You are injecting it systemically. So it is going to go everywhere. Not exclusive, not a local injection. There are ways around it, but it's still going to go everywhere. So okay, you want to be aware of, because it's a toxicity issue. It's not a chemotherapeutic, you're actually trying to get an image out of it. You can't have a long-lasting toxic agent circulating in the system for a long time. People have also used other targeting approaches to make these, in this case, prostate cancer, for example. Most patients with prostate cancer get some kind of androgen deprivation therapy, castration, surgical, chemical, or it could be one of these other AR targeted therapies that actually made this essentially a radioactive testosterone. So you can actually now, by using this targeted type of agent, you can now see the AR is actually signaling is actually active or not in patients before and after treatment. And what you're seeing here is actually what we call a waterfall plot. You can actually, they try to look at the correlation between glucose uptake and testosterone uptake. Not quite consistent, as you would imagine. But the idea is, can this potentially be your testosterone uptake should be different. Again, these are all not necessarily clinically approved. Some of them are clinically approved, but not these targeted ones. You can, again, pick another moiety, in this case, PSMA, to do the same thing. You have it based on the signal that you get on PET. If you had a tumor that had high AR activity and low PSMA, you won't get a lot of signal. But if it had low AR activity, now you're going to get a lot of signal. So if you actually were to administer some kind of AR-based therapy, you might be able to get a non-invasive early readout of a therapeutic efficacy. Okay, that's for PET. Ultrasound, another imaging modality that's clinically utilized quite a bit. Most of you probably have intuitively heard of ultrasound. The only image that you see in the pregnant woman with the fetus that you see. I'll give you some examples. But basically, conceptually, ultrasound is just referring to those sound pressure waves that we need to detect. I don't know if you guys have heard of echolocation. Bats, they don't see. They see, but they actually detect based on their hearing. Sonar and the concept, sound navigation and ranging, that's basically the same thing. It's based on transmitting sound waves and see what comes back. Right? I always joke with my students when I talk about ultrasound, the simplest way to look at it ultrasound, you yell at the tumor, it's really all that. You know that. You figure out how much you yell more so more than you, you know, less than you. That's really what it is, right? Because that's the simplest way of looking at it. What is bouncing off? As I mentioned, most of you have probably seen this image. You see that the fetus in the pregnant woman. You see the technician holding the transducer in the belly. So it's basically an imaging method that exploits sound waves and how they interact with tissue. It's a non-invasive way to give you structural and functional information. One of the things I will tell you, this is a lot less intimidating than, I don't know if any of you have ever had an MRI or a CT scan. Have you? How was it?
Terrible.
How was yours? Scary. I don't know, like I said, if you've never seen this, but I'm happy to take you, walk you through the tour. It is a giant, looks like a nuclear reactor. In fact, MRI used to be, is based on the principle of nuclear magnetic resonance. It used to be called NMR, but thinking about World War I, World War II, and all of a sudden they're using the word nuclear when going to the hospital. People freak out and have you put that away. MRI PET scanner gantries are intimidating. But in second, an MR scanner looks like field light eternity. But the gradients, I mentioned magnitude gradients, they turn on, they give you headsets and whatnot. Not fun. This, I said, and think about it, not from your perspective, think about it from a 7-year-old cancer patient. Lots and lots less intimidation. You're already going through a life-changing experience. And on top of it, chemo, radiation, surgery, now this other imaging method I have to go through, that you have to go through every 2 weeks. So that's a big advantage to these ultrasound, and even optical imaging methods. I know some of you are working with optical imaging methods. Something hands up, you can see. But you don't. Yeah, feel it. Nothing. Takes a minute. Not easy. Right? So there's a huge advantage to these methods. The trade-off, of course, is you're not getting whole body. You're getting localized areas. Right? And abdomen, head and neck, what have you. Again, to my earlier point, everything is a trade-off. What you would like to see versus how much time you're willing to spend to get that image versus how much money you're willing to spend, everything matters. This is what the gantry looks like. That's a clinical scanner. This is a preclinical scanner. Again, we have one dedicated for small animals and even large animals. You can see a very similar setup. You have a CPU. You have a transducer unit that's the technician's holding here. It's basically collecting content and receiving signals, and you have a device that's storing the image and processing it. Okay, the principle behind ultrasound, as I mentioned, is really transmission of sound waves. And typically what that does, how that works is your transducer actually provides that ultrasound beam, typically at a 1 millimeter slice thick. Beam profile, as we call it. And what it does is it has these mechanical oscillators in there that actually produce that vibration. So when that vibration is directed at a particular part of the body, you typically you'll see if there's a transducer that's being held. I don't know if you guys have
all the time for seniors, but you actually want that through that picture image. You capture that image and you go through it, and you're standing as the belly pregnant woman in this case, right? What is he doing? He's trying to localize. Let me find out the extent. What do I want to do? Same thing if you wanted to do and anywhere in your body, doesn't matter. And what it does is collecting the reflected signal as an echo. Again, going back to the echolocation, right? It's trying to identify what kind of a signal did I get. It's transforming it into an electrical signal and giving you an image. That return, that echo, depends on the type of tissue you're imaging and how deep those tissues are. So transmission of sound wave is what really gives you that contrast. MR on the biophysical basis is that proton density, water, PET, the reactive tracer, and the ultrasound is really transmission of sound wave for the tissue. And that's typically influenced by the tissue density. And so between bone to soft tissue, there's a difference. So this difference in tissue density is actually manifested as a difference in that signal. So here's an example of that. Between bone to tissue to gas, for example, you see that difference in that mismatch, or the tissue density results in what we call an acoustic mismatch, and that's what you get a signal. So you get a much more dramatic, much more broader acoustic mismatch. If bone to gas, for example, is actually going to decrease your penetration, causing artifacts. So again, similar to MRI, there's a lot of use for diagnostic purposes. You know, prostate, for example, utilized, ovarian cancer, utilized. The nice thing is it's local, so if you were suspecting, whether it's for prostate or ovarian or even neck masses, for example, you can survey that region and say, oh, there's no mass, or there is mass. Here's an example. Typical frequencies for humans, anywhere from 2 to 15 megahertz. Animals is slightly different. You go to the higher frequencies. Given the size differences, this is an example of a melon. This is a coffee bean analogy between a human being and an animal like a mouse. Interestingly, the technology is actually quite a bit advanced. If you can actually go down to some spectacularly high resolution, that's a 30 micron resolution. That's a fetus in a mouse. So you can think of the scaling up and down to what's going there, going from a human being to a mouse, to a pregnant mouse, and trying to image the fetus in that. So it's quite a bit, it's quite diverse in its application. Again, similar to PET, if I got one of these labels and I showed you this image, how many of you will be able to identify what I was even referring to? Brain, kidney, prostate, ovary, breast? There's no way to tell. So that's the other trade-off. All the time, again, there's a steep learning curve. It's not necessarily intuitive. It doesn't look, again, just like PET, you don't have great spatial resolution. Once you start doing it and start seeing the anatomic landmarks, it is easier to interpret these images, but it's not necessarily foolproof. You get certain characteristics, certain areas, bone, diaphragm, reflecting a lot more. Blood, for example, doesn't reflect anything. You actually see the incava, the portal vein, it'll actually look black or dark. So it's great for soft tissue imaging, especially when you know where to look for, right? You're not going to be doing whole body surveys for this. It's going to take you for a long time, which you can accomplish with MR or PET, but it's really for a regional screening purpose. Again, similar to the other methods, you can do anatomic imaging, functional imaging, and even molecular imaging, morphologic assessments, you can do functional readouts, and even targeted contrast agents, just like the ones I showed you for PET. Here's a simple example of morphologic measurements. This is a prostate tumor, ultrasound image of a prostate tumor in a mouse. You can actually see that nice big tumor. You can correlate it spatially with the histologic image. Fairly straightforward to do. You can also inject these microbubbles that give you contrast. You can also utilize red blood cells for contrast in ultrasound. But these will give you a little bit more contrast than that to measure intravenously, you're measuring vascularity. Here's an example of that. Forget the method. If you look at a contrast enhancement similar to MRI, you get a time intensity profile. You look at this image, in this case it's the kidney. Before contrast injection, you don't see a lot of signal. After contrast, you can see it actually starts accumulating predominantly in the cortex. And then the medulla actually fills out a little bit later.
So you can now get a functional readout of the vascularity. You can make targeted agents similar to the PET tracer example I gave you. You can make a microbubble that's targeted to the receptor, the VEGF receptor. So you can now measure what the VEGF relative VEGF expression levels are in the tumor, or VEGF receptor expression levels. You can quantify this before and after treatment with an anti-VEGF agent. Now you're specifically looking at the target that you're going to modulate with your therapy. You can do a little bit more fancy modeling, look at multiple parameters, peak enhancement. Anytime you do a time curve, right? This is true for most curves. Every curve, time worth of intensity of some sort. You get the peak, you get the time to peak, you get the clear out. It's almost analogous to the area of the curve. For drug concentration, plasma concentration, doesn't matter. Same idea. You can get how quickly it enhanced, how much it enhanced, how quickly it cleared out, all of which is giving you some indication of the functionality of the blood vessel in that tumor. Similar to MRI, as I showed you, you can generate parametric maps of each of these, and you can also do, I mentioned heterogeneity, you can actually get sub-regional heterogeneity, right, within a tumor. So this is what we call regions of interest, ROI. You can drop multiple ROIs. So in the B-node image, or even in this contrast enhanced image, it looks like the whole tumor enhanced, but you can tell if you were to drop multiple areas, all of them actually have a different profile. So the green area enhanced a lot less than the ones that are outlined in yellow and blue. Now if you actually generate the parametric map, you can actually see that. If this is going from blue to yellow, low to high, the purple actually got a lot more enhanced. Part of that tumor got a lot more enhancement than the other part. Now you're looking at spatial heterogeneity within a tumor, and this is in a single slice, and you can do it for the whole three-dimensional body. Excuse me. You can also use this method to actually track disease progression, both not just advanced stage disease. In this case, they actually used it for in an animal model, trying to look for transformation in the early stages, all the way from a healthy breast tissue to hypoplasia to BCIF, the carcinoma in situ, versus invasive cancer, and they actually use this VEGF receptor targeted contrast agent. Now you're actually getting a measure of one of the things, it's not the only thing driving the tumor, but you're essentially getting a readout of the VEGF receptor expression in that tumor as it's actually going. This is a model that's mimicking clinical disease progression, right? So the cell line where you just inject the invasive tumor cell into the mind. So you can actually say, here, this is also focused on diagnostic delineation or differences between benign and hyperplastic and benign and malignant. So they're making the argument that you can actually use this now to distinguish between benign and malignant disease. Another method that sort of builds off of ultrasound is called photoacoustic imaging, and as the name implies, there's a light element to it and a sound element to it. It's very similar, the setup looks very similar to an ultrasound system, except you actually have a fiber optic array built into that transducer that I just showed you. So what the difference is, you actually can get co-registered ultrasound images in addition to the photoacoustic signal, which is relying on an optical path. So your fiber, your transducer has a light fiber optic array built in. I mentioned ultrasound is sound in, sound out. Optoacoustic is light in, sound out. And the way that works is you have an optical path, you have this pulse laser that's illuminating your tissue of interest, absorbs things in the tissue, get absorbed or absorb that light, undergo thermoelastic expansion and generate these pressure waves that you're now picking up in your transducer. So it's similar to ultrasound or adaptive, but it's combining the strengths of ultrasound and optical imaging. And what are those strengths? One of the things, as it turns out, things in tissue all absorb different light at different wavelengths and at different intensities. So the absorption coefficient is actually different. Some of the common endogenous species in tissue that can absorb light, one big one is hemoglobin, water, melanin, fat, etc. Particularly for hemoglobin, there's a benefit, as you can see with the curve, depending on whether or not it's actually carrying oxygen, the absorption profile actually. You can actually see there's this difference between oxyhemoglobin and deoxyhemoglobin. So perhaps this could be important for contrast. Melanin, certainly, if you're trying to image melanin. You can also do contrast enhancing agents. There's a whole lot of interest in developing these agents. Won't get into the interest of time. Here's an example. This is melanin. This is a melanoma. And again, you can see pretty exquisite contrast from the melanin and from the blood vessels. You can also quantify what we call oxygen saturation, which is the ratio of that oxy to deoxy. So which is indirectly telling you how well or poorly oxygenated your tissue is. So this gives you an idea. Again, the normal brain, you can see quite a bit as you would assume, as you would expect. There's high levels of oxygen saturation, but in the tumor, it's actually much lower, given that the tumor vessels are deficient, structurally deficient, inherently functionally inadequate. We've actually done quite a bit of work on this. This is actually a preclinical model. This is work from a former grad student, looking at therapies that actually affect the blood vessels of tumors. You can even alter the hemodynamic status of the tumors by using agents like carbonyl. Carbonyl is 95% oxygen, 5% CO2. Carbonyl breathing will actually change your hemodynamic, will induce a hemodynamic response, which is what you're seeing here at baseline in your skin. Tumors also will respond, but perhaps not as much as you can see. So what Lori did here is actually treated these animals with this vascular targeting agent and imaged them with photoacoustic imaging, their oxygen saturation before and after treatment. And here you can actually see two things happening. One, and this is in a head and neck tumor model, you can see the good news is the treatment was relatively selective, at least from the imaging data set, because the normal skin response is pretty intact, not changed. Whereas the tumor that was enhancing before basically is lower. The oxygen saturation is dramatically reduced. So you can see that in the quantitative image, they're actually, because the drug actually shuts down the blood vessels of these tumors, you can now indirectly quantify. And this is at 24 hours after a single dose. So fairly quickly, going back to my earlier point about early imaging readouts, functional readouts. You can correlate this with histologic measures, additional methods like MRI. Here's actually a different work. This is also work from my grad students, looking at tumors, you know, with ultrasound, with MRI, and looking at the exposure pre-oxygen and post-oxygen, 100% pure oxygen, hyperoxia. You can see the signal increases in the tumor, as you would expect, on both MRI and on photoacoustic imaging. Total hemoglobin doesn't quite change, there's no reason to. But when you look at the pattern, you can actually spatially correlate this image with the histology, and you can actually see the reason why you're only seeing the signal in this part of the tumor, because that's the only part that's actually viable in the vascular rest. The other half of the tumor where you're not seeing anything, basically necrotic on the H&E. So now you're getting a pretty good readout of the functionality and oxygenation status using multiple imaging methods and multiple resolutions. Clinically, there's a lot of interest. We hopefully, next year when we give this class, we'll kind of do trials open here. We're trying to push this in the clinic for head and neck patients, and then maybe even breast and melanoma patients. That's what we're going on here. There's obviously a lot of interesting fields for all kinds of cancers and all kinds of medical conditions, not just oncologic, bone and joint disease, et cetera. So it's certainly exciting. This is in a clinical example from work done in Rochester, where they looked at ex vivo imaging. They excised these prostates and measured their oxy and deoxy hemoglobin profiles to see if they can distinguish between healthy prostatic tissue and prostate that was transformed or that already transformed. And they showed that there is a different signature. So there's a lot of interest in the diagnostic application of photoacoustic imaging. And then finally, I'll just wrap things up with optical imaging, which is predominant in the preclinical space, and to some extent, given optoacoustic is one of them, is also being utilized in the clinical space. Optical imaging, as most of you probably know, is referring to, within the electromagnetic spectrum, some wavelength or energy that's being utilized. So unlike ionizing radiation, optical imaging methods utilize visible UV or IR, which are non-ionizing, therefore safer for patients. So you don't have to, you can only get so many CT scans. and only have so many cut scans. But again, going back to my original flashlight analysis, right? And not just white light or fluorescent light, visible or NIR. Not harmful. You can get pretty good images of tissues and organs. One of the biggest advantages is that it's really quick. That minimal amount of time by the time you set up in the MR scanner, lay down the gantry, protocol the set, 10 to 15 minutes. This is a minute. A patient's awake, standing, sitting, laying down, a lot less intimidating for patients. It's, for the most part, semi-quantitative, certainly in terms of post-processing, there's some work that needs to be done, especially if you're seeing a lot of artifact, but it certainly has considerable strengths. Limitation, as I mentioned earlier, is light only goes so far, and depending on the kind of light. So blue light is even less, red, as you go from the red NIR, you will get a lot more penetration, but we're still talking in the range of millimeters to centimeters. So it's not whole body, and this is a limitation that I want you to recognize. Signal intensity, therefore, whatever you're measuring as a readout signal, is actually dependent on the depth from which it's coming back. Most commonly utilized research methods, some of you may have already been using such methods in your labs, if you have a lab that you're working on a project on, either fluorescence or bioluminescence, which are two different methods within that optical imaging paradigm. They both have some commonality. They both rely on light that's emitted, usually involves either collecting photons using a CCD camera, but they also vary in some aspects, and we'll briefly go over that. Again, in terms of the potential for optical imaging reporters, this explosive utilization in cancer research and medical research in general, mostly because you can manipulate these things in your model of interest, whether it's a cell line, you have a mouse model, a rat model, your favorite. In fact, people have even generated transgenic models that are expressing red and green fluorescent reporters. Of course, the firefly is a big inspiration for the luciferase bioluminescence systems. You can make tags similar to the contrast agents I mentioned. You can make targeted dyes, fairly innocuous. And you can label your cells, label your protein of interest, and measure whatever process you're interested in measuring. So bioluminescence imaging, again, some of you may have actually been or are actively utilizing this method in your research. Doesn't require an external light for excitation. What it's really doing is capturing a biochemical reaction that's happening. And that biochemical reaction is actually a light-producing reaction. And so if you had a mouse with a tumor expressing a specific enzyme, luciferase, which is the, as I will mention in a minute, essential for the reaction to take place, and if you inject a substrate, luciferin, you see this enzymatic reaction occurring, it's a light-producing reaction. You can now capture that and see what it really reflects, the underlying tumor growth, perhaps overexpression, driving signal in the tumor. Again, as I mentioned, it's fairly easy to use, fairly high throughput. You can do up to 5 animals at a time in the preclinical stage, and it's fairly quick. So the biochemical reaction that I mentioned is really this, your luciferase protein. Typically, you have a reporter construct. Most common use is a cell line that already has this built in. So when you inject luciferin in the substrate, it undergoes an enzymatic reaction, producing oxyluciferin and light, which is really what's being picked up by the CCD device. We have multiple systems that do this. One of the benefits of these multi-spectral systems is you have a whole bunch of excitation emission filters that you can use. And there's quite a bit of utilization that I mentioned in preclinical research. Keep in mind, bioluminescence is not clinically utilizable, because you are using a manipulated or manipulatable system. You can measure tumor growth. This is a lung tumor model, you know, with these cells expressing luciferase and GFP. This is CT combined with bioluminescence, co-registering the images to show tumor growth. You can also do it in hematologic malignancies. This is in a mouse model of leukemia. After injection of cells systemically, you can see all, eventually the whole mouse lights up, disseminating to each of the entire system. You can quantify this as a photon count signal over time. You can obviously then validate it even ex vivo if you open up the animal. But there are caveats. The luciferase enzyme, the stability itself, is an influence. How you administer luciferin, the substrate, makes a big difference in what you see. When you image after administering, these are all particularly relevant for those of you who are actually going to be using or are using biogenetics in your own research. You might want to keep these things in mind. The timing when you're acquiring, just as the dynamic curve that I showed you initially, there's a temporal nature of these events. So when you actually image them after injection matters. And so certain sites can be a problem, but these are some of the caveats. So here's an example. IV injection of luciferin compared to subcutaneous injection compared to intraperitoneal. Completely different biodistribution profile. So keep that in mind. How you position the animal makes a difference. On the left, prone, supine, all these things matter. This is the same thing clinically, two other methods. There's a reason why we do certain claims in three-dimensional data center. Certain physical regions or objects, anatomic obstructions can change the way you look at that image. Here's the time profile. You can see completely different kinetic profiles of the signal after three different routes of administration. So whatever you use in your study, a lot of people use IP injections. Just keep in mind, it is influenced by how you administer the substrate and when you image. Keep in mind, not just the route, but also when you image them. So that's why fluorescence has certainly been around for a long time. Goes back to Sir George Gabriel Stokes, who was a physicist who discovered this, that when you use the solar spectrum or solution, you saw that when white light was put through the prism, and you guys hopefully remember this from your early physical biology classes, you can see you end up getting longer wavelength on the other side. In fact, this Stokes shift is what it's called. It's basically this re-emitted light is always longer wavelength compared to what was actually emitted upon that prism. Same idea in vivo. Utilize a fluorophore if you want, a tag that you can put on the animal or the cell line or tissue of interest. You can excite that fluorophore, and when when that fluorescent light emission occurs, you can capture that with your camera. So that light emission is detected based on the filters that you have. Similar to what I showed you before, that those systems have a broad range of filters, from 400 to 850, over 20 filter sets. So you can actually, even if you had overlapping spectra, you could actually keep them out, spectrally separate them out. So of course, if you go longer wavelength, you get much more penetration, so it's better, and there's minimal background autofluorescence. Here's an example to show that. This is a green fluorescent protein. It's a tumor expressing green fluorescent protein. A tumor expressing red fluorescent protein. Again, red may be better for certain deeper penetration in certain organs in the brain, for example. You can also combine bioluminescence and fluorescence. This is a tumor cell line that's expressing luciferase. It's a bioluminescent signal. This is actually a fluorescent dye that's focused on imaging the blood vessels, and this is actually an optically labeled glucose. So now you can actually measure tumor growth, angiogenesis, and metabolism all within 2 minutes and an hour. So there are benefits to this multi-spectral imaging. You can unmix, as I said. If you know what your fluorophores are and what their profiles look like, you can essentially separate them out. Each of these, as you can see, can unmix these pixels within a tumor, for example. Needless to say, there's a whole huge market for these agents, preclinically, labeled with every marker imaginable: cancer, arthritis, inflammation, infectious diseases, fibrosis. All of these are commercially available agents. They're not exactly cheap, but they are available for your research if any of you are interested. You can do the same thing that I mentioned in the phantom. You can multiplex. Here's an example of multiple quantum dots injected into the lymph nodes of these, into the lymphatic tracts of these animals. What this allows you is then separate out the localization of these two signals. So if you were imagining two different drugs getting to a tumor, optically active drugs. You can now actually co-localize. Did both drugs get to the tumor? Did only one get to the tumor? Did none of them get to the tumor? Or what tumor? In this case, these are draining lymph nodes. Head and neck, as I mentioned, is one of the sites where a lot of tumor can go to your draining lymph nodes. So perhaps you can even measure the presence of nodal metastases in these non-invasively. You can also quantify vasculature post-therapy, similar to the example I gave you before. And finally, I'll just close with one of the big directions that certainly we are going and the field is going is actually, as I mentioned in the beginning with radiation oncology, the treatment planning is one. But you can actually use image to guide your therapies. Ultrasound can be used to guide where you're injecting a tumor, for example. You can use the same thing to monitor a therapy like PDT. I put in a couple of slides in here because I think you should know. PDT was actually developed here at Roslyn Park by Dr. Tom Doherty. If you're interested, the man still comes in once or twice a week. One of the most easily approachable guys. A lot of you wouldn't think this is the guy who developed the treatment. PDT is now a clinically approved treatment for cancer. And that was developed down the hall, MRC. So it's not often that you get to see someone who developed a cancer therapy, right? So if you are interested, I mean, he might hate me for sending all of us to do it his way, but if you are interested, you certainly, I encourage you to at least go talk. It's always a fascinating experience to meet and hear stories from Tom. But he developed this when he observed that with fluorescein, that when he, what he called the vital standard, that when he exposed these cells to light after fluorescein, they actually were killed. So that was the first observation. Now, of course, as I said, it's actually FDA-approved for a whole bunch of cancer and non-oncologic indications. The way this works, we have PDT trials here for head and neck and lung. You inject this photosensitizer, similar to that fluorescein that initially Tom used. You inject the photosensitizer that accumulates, not necessarily selectively, but over time there is a discrepancy in the relative accumulation between tumor and normal tissue. You then illuminate just the tumor. That's where the cells could be actually coming from. Not necessarily from the distribution of the sensitizer, but you're not irradiating the whole body. You're illuminating just the tumor, in this case, in the head and neck region. You could then, PDT actually does a whole bunch of things when you do that. It generates free radicals, which is the main mechanism of action, but it also causes cellular damage, vascular damage, triggers into the whole immune inflammatory response, all of which contribute to the ultimate outcome. You can actually use imaging to guide. So here's an example of a patient. This is actually a pretty bulky tumor in the neck. You can actually use MRI, for example, the guide where you're in place. You can do what we call interstitial imaging. As I mentioned, optical imaging or light in general has been limited by penetration. So if you have a 6 centimeter mass, you're going to illuminate the surface. You're not going to get a whole lot of light that you go into the deeper part of the tumor. The way to overcome that is actually by inserting fiber optic light sources, essentially, into the tumor. Now, imaging can actually be utilized to actually guide these fibers and say, how many do I need to place? Where do I want to place them? Again, sparing normal tissue is a critical piece, but maximum tumor cell kill. So this is another example where imaging can actually guide treatment. You can also use it to actually monitor. We've done this here. This is one of my former med students who did the work in an animal model where she actually used MRI to guide fiber placement in the interstitial of the tumor. You can see that in the scans that the arrow is pointing to that fiber tract. You can also monitor if the tumor responded or not using a whole series of MRI methods. You can also monitor during light treatment. We actually had a fiber. This is in a rat model. This is your work from a long time ago, but we can in real time monitor the changes that are occurring during light exposure. What you're seeing here are actually minutes pre and post light treatment. You can actually see two different light regimens have completely differential effects on the tumor, and then you get a real-time monitoring of the PDT efficacy. Another application for image-guided intervention is surgical guidance based on optical imaging. This is actually being done now in the clinic, where they have a near-IR dye labeled to an EGFR monoclonal antibody. This actually is actually clinically approved for head and neck.
And the idea is, in the clinic or in the OR in real time, you can get it. If you were to inject this dye into the patient, you would get a real time image of the localization. It can be used for two things. One, to really determine the extent of the tumor, perhaps the aggressiveness. The second is actually to help you resect, help the surgeon resect the tumor with minimal damage or sparing normal tissue. And then you can also validate this ex vivo. So that's really where image guided interventions are. And there's been studies done with these are also in the phase 1-2 stages where they're trying to utilize the or evaluate the utility of these imaging guided procedures on how better the surgical resection, particularly in a disease like head and neck, is very critical. You can have a cancer of the oral cavity or pharynx. You can just certainly keep resecting your vocal cord, for example, and have a huge impact on your quality of life, speech, swallowing function, etc. So this is an exciting area of research that's trying to see if we can minimize some of the comorbidity post-surgery if we would improve the efficiency of surgical procedures using this image guidance. So, to recap, what I've tried to cover, and I know we covered a lot of ground and probably faster than you would want me to, or certainly than I wanted to, but suffice to say, at least recognize that there are a whole bunch of imaging methods that are being used in the clinical setting, and most of them are also actively being utilized in the preclinical setting. Most, not all of them carry over optical imaging, being one of them, but most of the other methods do have translational utility, so go back and forth. In some ways, it's bedside to bedside and back. So it's a two-way street both ways. So recognize that questions come from the clinic, but answers can come from the lab, and so glad to go back to the clinic to test. Again, this is not meant to be in isolation. I don't mean you can't hear and tell you anything is everything. Something else is important. Pathology and histopathology will still be the gold standard for assessing tumors. Pathologists are not going to be out of job anytime soon. But the idea is to correlate these imaging readouts, molecular imaging, diagnostic radiology, functional imaging methods, with genomics. Certainly an explosion of genomic methods, high throughput methods have occurred. Ultimately, to see if this is all in the paradigm of precision medicine, right? To see if we can correlate the radiologic features with the pathologic features to identify therapies. Okay, let's just revisit this real quick. What is this? MRI? Okay. You are correct. Second one? X-ray, okay. Third? It is a fluorescent protein, yes. It's not, it's a fluorescent image, not a fluorescent protein. This one? Pet image, and this one. So that's actually an ultrasound image, but it actually has the overlay of the microbial cancer, so the targeted microbial. Okay, that's it. Any questions, comments? As far as the test goes, I think it's coming up soon, I'm sure. I would hope that you recognize, understand the concepts. I'm not going to question you on what is the half-life of that one tracer in that table, and ask you to design your study, an imaging study, for your own, either a preclinical study, or I can give you the experiment and say what imaging method you would use. So it's going to be applied knowledge, not writing. Of course, you have to have some basic concepts understood, but it's going to be that sort of question. And certainly will not overlap with the questions that some of you guys have taken together for. So don't get too comfortable. No questions? All right, thank you.